Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Monday, February 22nd, 2016. Present we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Newman, Representative Edgman, Representative Guttenberg, and I'm Representative Thompson. So, before we start, please be reminded that no cell phones or electronic devices are allowed to be utilized in committee. This afternoon, we'll have a continuation of our dialogue on long-range physical plans involving the Permanent Fund, House Bill 224, 245, and 303. Here today is David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division, with a presentation of a comparison of plans to replumb Alaska's cash flow. And for the members, please, if you have a question about a specific one of these bills, if you get that in writing to my staff, we can get you the answers, because I think that in order to answer those questions, we'd have to have the bill sponsors here, and they're not all here. So if you have a specific question to a specific bill, please get those to my staff, Jane, and we'll get you the answers in writing. And Mr. Teal, please place yourself on the record and begin your presentation. If you have questions during this, if it's on that slide, I don't mind it. But if we start referencing further future slides, let's stick to the slide we're on, if you can, with the questions. Go ahead, Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And Ledge Finance has prepared a model that allows us to compare the various fiscal plans, and I believe that a model is the best way to compare the plans, because it allows you to compare projected deficits, dividends, and reserve balances under the three options. But unless you first understand how the plans differ and how they're the same, the models are simply black boxes that spit out numbers and graphs, and I'm not sure how useful that is. So, although cash flow diagrams are really simplistic representations of the options, they do show only where money flows, not the amounts that are flowing, and that's a definite weakness. On the other hand, they're very, although they can't tell you if a plan is fiscally sound, and they can't tell you how a plan would respond to changes in interest rates or to oil revenues, they can help you see where the decision points are, and they can help you understand the trade-offs that are inherent in those decisions. And I think you need to understand both of those things before you can really understand the model output. So the following slides show that cash flow under various models, and we're starting here with the current cash flow. And then we'll show how cash flow would change under HB 245, which I will probably half the time refer to as the governor's bill or the Permanent Fund Protection Act. I hope that's not confusing. It'll also talk about HB 303 and HB 224. On 303, I might refer to it as the POMV plan or something, too. So if there's any question about which plan I'm referring to, please let me know, because it's confusing enough. So we'll turn to the model output after reviewing the diagrams of cash flow. On the first diagram, current cash flow, let's start with the permanent fund, meaning both the principal and the earnings reserve account. Note that they're separated from the general fund, no arrows connecting them, and with minor exceptions, cash from the permanent fund accounts are not used for government expenditures. Second, here, earnings from the investments of the permanent fund and the earnings reserve account itself accumulate in the earnings reserve account. Dividends are the first priority. It's just a five-year moving average. And they depend on investment earnings. There's no firm connection to the fiscal health of the state. And there are strong rules for paying dividends that they're written right into statute. You might also notice there's a loop here between the permanent fund principal and the earnings reserve account, where the statutory net income flows into the account, accumulates there. There's also a loop going back. That's inflation proofing. And that's an annual mechanical process that's also outlined in statute.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra and Representative Gaddis. Continue, David.
Okay. Now, turning to the general fund, you'll see that general fund royalties come, general fund revenues come from royalties, the production tax, and other less volatile revenue, which I think you've heard, you've asked the Department of Revenue what those were, and it's roughly $800 million of taxes, fees, and so on that don't change as much with oil prices. These are your volatile sources of revenue. So just in rough numbers right now, royalties flowing into the general fund are about $800 million, production taxes about $200 million, and the less volatile is another $800 million. That gives you 1.88 total revenue, which is what you'll see in the fiscal summary. Again, when oil prices are high, the revenue from royalties and production tax move up, and we may have revenue in excess of spending. Any surplus typically goes to reserves, generally meaning the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve Account, but it could also be the Statutory Budget Reserve Account. This is a simplified diagram. The Statutory Budget Reserve is not on here, doesn't really make any difference. And I guess you could argue that when we have surpluses, there should be an arrow going from the general fund to reserves. But what we're really trying to show here is the current deficit situation. And when there's a deficit, we draw from reserves. And although this system has worked for 25 years, it really can't work in a low production, low price environment. Because in that environment, which we have now, we're constantly drawing from reserves but never replenishing them. And in that situation, we'll simply run out of reserves at some point. So the model shows that reserves will be exhausted in about FY19. You heard the same thing from the Department of Revenue. I think our model output is very similar to theirs and to GCI's model. So I don't think we're arguing about facts or flows or amounts, interest rates or revenue. All three models show pretty much the same thing.
We've been joined by Representative Munoz.
So the next five slides will show how the Permanent Fund Protection Act would change the fiscal plumbing. The first change is that we're switching from savings mode into harvesting mode. By that, I just mean that in the past, we've always deposited money to the permanent fund, never taken any money out. Of course, you can't take it from the principal, but you could take it from reserves. We have not. We have only saved, and we're now considering beginning to harvest some of those reserves. So the change here is that because we're going into harvest mode, we're reducing the savings. And the current flow is about 25% of royalties, 30% now flow in. That is confusing to some people, because there are actually two provisions. It's 25% of old leases, pre-1980, and 50% of revenue from new leases. But since the revenue from the new fields is so much smaller than from Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, that the average of the two is 30%. Under the plan, you would ignore the 50% of royalties just from the new fields. All fields would drop to 25%. And, of course, that extra 5% can be switched to the portion of royalties that flows to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, do you say we could ask technical questions or no?
Yes, on those slides. Representative Guerra.
Just Technically, Mr. Teal, did the governor change back the royalty rate that goes into the permanent fund at 25? His proposal is to not have any of those 50% royalty fields. Is that it? That money just goes straight into the general fund now?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the Constitution says it's a minimum of 25%. By statute, we increased that rate to 50% for fields that were developed after 1980. So this is removing that statutory provision, going back to the constitutional minimum. And
I understand.
And your question is, excuse me, does it go into the general fund? The answer is no, because the second change from the current system is moving both of these royalties and production tax, those volatile sources of revenue, would be moved from the general fund and now go to the ERA.
Thanks.
We have a couple more questions, David. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real briefly, Mr. Teal, you said that we've never pulled money out of the earnings reserve account, but inflation proofing is by statute and a simple majority of the legislature does pull money out of the earnings reserve account for inflation proofing, right?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes. And when it may be confusing, when we talk permanent fund, often we're talking about the permanent fund and the ERA, since the ERA is part of the permanent fund. So, yes, inflation proofing does move money from the ERA, the spendable portion of the permanent fund, into the unspendable portion. And there actually is some money flowing from the earnings reserve to general funds, but it's very small. It is the permanent fund division itself. The permanent fund corporation spends earnings, and then there's about $8 million that goes split between the departments of law, revenue, and natural resources for activities related to what they consider to be increasing flow to the permanent fund. So
I'd also like to recognize in the room that we have former representative and former co-chair of Senate or House Finance, Bill Thomas. Thank you for being here, Mr. Thomas. We have another question from Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. Actually, just to clarify that last statement on the earnings reserve draws, it's not very much, I guess. And is that, and I guess historically, is that, that's by precedent, is that how those draws have been done through the earnings reserve account?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, precedent going back to the five-year plan of the late 1990s when there was a big push to reduce general fund spending, and those three departments found a way to substitute permanent fund earnings for their general funds. Again, about $8 million. It used to be probably six when they started it, but it's increased over time.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
I guess so. None of us were here during that time, but oh yeah, that's right. You were. It was your fault. Okay. I guess my real question though is, I guess from the previous slide, going from a 30% that we currently do historically do to a 25%, does that materially change the permanent fund principle? And have you mapped that out at all?
Again, through the chair, I would argue it's not a very material change if you consider that royalties are about $1 billion. So changing 5% is a $50 million redirection of the earnings from principal. But compared to inflation proofing, which is approaching $1 billion, that $50 million is dwarfed.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman has joined us in the audience. Thank you for being here.
Yes. Sure, I think there was a math error.
Pardon?
I think there was a math error on that.
Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. This could be the first time ever, David, that maybe my math is better than yours, but probably not. So, if $1 billion is going into the permanent fund from royalties with the current 30% rate, you're not, by going to 25%, you're not reducing it by 5%. You're reducing it by 1/6, roughly. So wouldn't that be more than $50 million that is no longer going into the permanent fund principal, going from 30% to 25%?
Mr. Chairman, I hate to say it, but I think my math is better than Representative.
Oh, no.
You've so been corrected. Representative Hughes, welcome.
And let me explain it. It isn't a 5% change in the sense that you're going from 30 to 25. It's 5% of royalties that are moving from this arrow to this arrow. So it's roughly $50 million. But
we'll give you a written page and calculator in a little while.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to slow
Representative
this down.
Representative Guerra.
I'll speak to David later, but I'm still not sure about that. So, but I assume he's right, just to be clear.
Go ahead, Mr. Teal. Oh.
Okay, well, whatever the amount, it's being diverted from the general fund to the earnings reserve, which, of course, leaves the general fund short of revenue by that amount, which is roughly 800 and 200. So $1 billion has been moved at current oil prices from the general fund to the ERA, leaving that short, and it is that $1 billion is more than made up by drawing from the earnings reserve account what the governor's bill refers to as the sustainable draw. So that sustainable draw is set by law at $3.3 billion. It can be adjusted downward if it's determined that oil revenues or interest rates don't allow it to stay at $3.3 billion and maintain the real value of the permanent fund. But it can be adjusted upward by inflation. So I guess if you want to think of this in dollar terms, even though the model is probably better at doing this, you just lost $1 billion of general fund revenue and replaced it with $3.3 billion of sustainable draw. So your net gain is $2.3 billion of deficit closing money. The fourth change is that inflation proofing changes. It moves from its annual statutory calculation to an overflow mechanism, which is just dependent upon the sustainable draw. When you're at four times a sustainable draw, they've determined that you're not going to run out of cash reserves anytime real soon, and therefore you can inflation proof again, meaning deposit into the corpus or principal. Now, inflation proofing is something that people may argue about. Some people think that we haven't inflation proofed the fund unless we actually make a transfer to the principal. In other words, they might say that this 25% is inflation proofing. Others would say that's not inflation proofing, that is savings. And not only can't you count it as inflation proofing, but you should be inflation proofing your savings deposit as well. Others would say transferring money from the earnings reserve account to the corpus makes it unspendable and therefore increases the risk of not being able to pay your sustainable draw. So the goal is simply to maintain the real market value of the sum of these two, so it doesn't really matter which account it's in. Take your pick. I think it's an academic argument that I find interesting, but I'm not sure that you really want to get into that here. So the fifth and final change is that...
We've been joined by Representative Reinbold and Representative Wohl. Welcome. Go ahead, David. Representative Wilson has a question while we're here.
Thank you. And it could be on either slide. So the sustainable draw, is it an actual figure or a formula? How do we know the sustainable draw, or does it just randomly change from legislature to legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it does not randomly change. The governor has a module in their model that determines the sustainable draw. It does that by saying, here's my oil flow, here's my interest earnings, and so on. I make projections of those, and I basically can say, if that's my cash inflow, I can afford to annuitize that at $3.3 billion a year and pay $3.3 billion forever. It also includes an inflation-proofing adjustment. So it goes up from $3.3 billion with inflation, but there's a review provision for moving it downward that can occur every 4 years, but it doesn't really matter. You could make it every 2 years if you wanted to. But theoretically, that sustainable draw is a fixed draw.
Thank you. That helps.
Representative Kawasaki.
Just generally on the sustainable draw itself and the $3.3 billion, is it sustainable? I can see that it in some years might not be a sustainable draw. I mean, am I right about that?
Through the chair, under the current set of assumptions, that draw is sustainable, but it is highly sensitive to interest rates and oil prices, because that's how the portfolio is replenished. So that if you earn far less than they propose, or if oil prices are lower, then 3.3 is not sustainable. That's why the bill contains a provision for review every 4 years and downward adjustment of that amount if you find that the real value of the permanent fund plus the ERA is not keeping pace with inflation.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
Just with abundance of caution, have you modeled like a worst case scenario and a best case scenario based on price and production for a draw?
Through the chair, yes, and we'll get to the models later. This is just kind of, as I said, where the money flows, but not how much, and not how sensitive it might be to assumptions or building in any changes to spending or revenue measures or any of that, all of which matter. So that's the model.
Wait. Go ahead, Mr. Teal.
Okay, we were talking about dividends, changing the source and amount. The source of dividends changes from permanent fund earnings a percentage of permanent fund earnings, an average of a five-year moving average, to now 50% of the previous year's royalties. So that changes both the source and the amount of those dividends. We could have put the line going directly from royalties to dividends, but our opinion was that would indicate that it's a flow in the current year. And of course, dividends are paid in October, 9 months before you know what your royalties are for the year, so you really can't do that. We have to base the permanent fund on a completed fiscal year so you know how much the dividend would be. So it's probably easiest to think of this as 74.5% of royalties flow into the earnings reserve account, 24.5% of it sits there, and just draw a dotted line between this arrow and this arrow, and 50% of the prior year's royalties flow out to the dividend fund and then to the people. So your opinion, I guess everyone's opinion may vary. This diagram is probably no more complicated than the current cash flow. You're going from there to there. It's certainly not something that you, I hope, can't understand because there are too many interrelated pieces. But if there are questions about that flow, I'd be happy to try to clear them up before we move on to the next one.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, if you're going to get to the amount of the dividend that produces later, then that's fine. Unless, or otherwise, I'll ask the question now. I just don't see it in the.
Through the chair, that is a later. That comes up when we talk about the models.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative the co-chair, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Mr. Teal, and could you talk a little bit more about the earnings reserve and the ability to put production taxes and royalties into that and then pull money back out of that? There's some, and you don't have to go into depth, but there's just some discussion on whether that's allowable or not allowable. Could you define that discussion for us?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. What you see is that the model works. I mean, conceptually, it was designed to reduce volatility, but reducing volatility means switching those flows from the general funds to the earnings reserve account. So the volatility has been moved, but there are some concerns. One of them is the legal issue. And again, this is opinion. The Attorney General said in Senate State Affairs that he would argue long and hard about the legality of doing so and the fact that doing so would not change the sweepability of the earnings reserve account. Our legislative legal staff says, you know, I guess no surprise that the lawyers don't always agree, but our lawyers say that's not the case. That the argument goes that depositing royalties, production tax, and the CBR, which also moves into the earnings reserve account, but which isn't shown on this diagram because it's a one-time event rather than a constant cash flow. So depositing those funds changes the character of the earnings reserve account. Currently, it holds only permanent fund earnings. That's why it's exempt from the sweep that occurs at the end of every year into the CBR. And when I say every year, it's every year in which we have a liability to the CBR. So if that fund no longer holds just permanent fund earnings, there may be a legal problem with the sweep. But I think the motivation for moving that money in there is pretty clear. The key objective of the plan is stability. That's how you get your stability, is moving your volatile revenue sources from the general fund to the ERA and replacing it with a very steady $3.3 billion fixed draw. Volatility is gone. Now, the CBR itself, I'm not sure that it was moved to avoid a vote, a supermajority vote on the CBR. It may have been. I haven't talked to anyone about it. I suspect it's because of the higher earnings. And you're not talking about the difference between the 1% that the budget reserve currently earns versus the 6.9 that we anticipate it to earn when it's in the earnings reserve account. The point is that when it earns money in the ERA, that money is spendable. CBR earnings accumulate in the CBR, and they're spendable with a supermajority vote. So it's both an increase in the rate of return, and on a $7 billion fund, 7% is $400+ million a year. It's not an insignificant move of money here. But as you said, it's not probably worth getting into the weeds on this. It's a completely legalistic argument. And I guess I would argue that the easiest solution is if you're concerned about sweep, don't actually move the CBR in there. Don't actually move your royalties or your production tax into the ERA. These can just be put in a holding tank. And then you compute the draw based on the sum of the holding tank, the CBR, the the ERA, and the principal. You don't have to physically move any money around. You just define your pool as the sum of four different things. So I think the legal issues are solvable if it comes to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know you and your office are looking into this to try and drill down and make sure that we're very clear on this before we take any action on this. I just wanted to make sure members, and not just finance members, but other legislators are aware of the discussion that's going on there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sadler.
Very brief question, Mr. Chair. What is the balance? I understand the CBR language requires us to refill it after it's been drawn against. What is the balance of the CBR? Is it always the highest it's ever been?
Through the chair, it is the highest it's ever been. I think what you're asking is, when do you pay it back? It's a ratcheting thing. You take money out, but if it's a $7 billion fund at one time, then we have a liability to the CBR every time we draw money out for any purpose. And we have a sweep until that full general fund liability to the CBR has been repaid.
Okay, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Mr. Teal, so the governor's plan, obviously there's the $3.3 billion draw that comes out of changing the permanent fund and royalties, or the way we put royalties into various accounts. But the governor's plan was more comprehensive than this. And so I think he wanted to produce something closer to a $4.5 billion or so annual draw. What is the impact of, you know, if people follow everybody in the hallways, which is, yeah, we can't do anything on oil taxes or oil tax credits or any of the other revenue measures the governor proposed, if you don't do any of those things other than the permanent fund part, how much does that reduce his sustainable annual plan by, roughly?
Through the chair, that's another model-type question, and you can see that very clearly. If you want to do that either here in committee or privately, we can go through the model and show precisely how those cash flows change in dollar amount. If you turn on the tax credits or the income tax or the rest of the tax plan, all those are individually selectable, and so you can see the other parts of the plan. And it's true here that the governor's plan is not merely changing cash flow, because this model is simply replumbing, and I think you've all heard that cuts can't fill the deficit, revenue can't fill the deficit, replumbing can't change the deficit. You may have to have a combination of all three in order to close it. The governor's full plan indicates that he's very well aware of that.
Continue, Mr. Steele.
Okay, there were, you know, legal issues were one concern about the plan. There are a few other concerns that we should perhaps talk about. I think the plan may actually be harmed by its own inflexibility. Currently, if we had an extra $4 billion, for instance, in production and royalty taxes, that entire $4 billion would be spendable by the legislature in the year in which it's received. You can spend it or you can save it. And just to put that in perspective, $4 billion is roughly equivalent to the revenue that we would get at $110 oil. So it's not some outrageous amount of money that's just pulled out of the air. It's getting back to where we've already been. And 110 is what it would take to balance the budget, approximately. So going back to the Permanent Fund Protection Act, that extra $4 billion does not go to the general fund. It goes to the ERA. And the sustainable draw would not increase now or in the future. It would still be $3.3 billion. There is no provision for increasing it. Now, if the bill allowed the sustainable draw to be adjusted upward for windfalls, you legislators might face the choice of, well, I can either spend $4 billion extra now, or I can spend roughly 1/20th of that, because I'm going to be spreading it over 20 or 25 years. But I can spend $200 million more per year, every year. And you make a choice as to how much you want to save and how much you want to spend based on that. Under this act, that because your sustainable draw would not go up if there were windfall revenues, you might be tempted to break the rules and say, well, I know there's all this extra revenue, I know where it's sitting, and you can't stop me from breaking the rules. I'm the legislature. I'm going to appropriate that money anyway for capital projects or anything else. And the concern is that if you have a rule-based system, you want to stick to the rules. And again, just a minor weakness of the plan, I would suggest that if you're going to do something like this, that the draw be adjusted upward as well as downward. Third is that the governor's bill relies heavily on long-term projections. That makes it sensitive to changes in interest rates and to changes in oil prices. And we'll see that more when we get to the model. Fourth is that a sustainable draw is not the same thing as a sustainable budget. Even if you could project the draw accurately, and 3.3 is sustainable, it doesn't necessarily fill the deficit, which, as you know, is closer to $3.8 billion. And now you're diverting $1 billion, so you've really only filled $2.3 billion of the deficit under this plan. So be careful when you use the word sustainable. Also remember that's true of any plan. The replumbing alone does not necessarily fill the anticipated deficits. The governor is aware of this, and that's why he included the expenditure reductions and the tax increases as part of his plan. Any questions on that, or should I now go to HB 303?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you just repeat back to if the production tax would end up being the $4 billion, and since it goes into the ERA, we would still be getting like $3.3 billion. So unless the less volatile revenue were to increase, there would really be no other way of putting things back into the CBR. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. If you assume that this money goes into the earnings reserve account, any extra that you don't spend, what you might call windfall gains of a single year of high oil prices, $4 billion, that goes into the ERA, and when the ERA balance reaches a sustainable point, then money goes into permanent fund principal. So there's no provision for repaying the constitutional budget reserve account.
Thank you.
Well,
that helps. Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, since we're going to go on to the next bill, I might as well ask on this bill now, and I'll ask on each of these. Obviously, I'm not going to hold it a secret to anybody and haven't. To the extent the only revenue measure that passes is the permanent fund part, I see it as completely imbalanced. So just so the public can understand, in the first year, the governor guarantees a certain dividend. But in future years, my understanding is if oil prices ranged between 30, which we hope they don't, or up to 70, which is the projected price, the governor's plan puts off a dividend of somewhere between $400 and $800. Is that right? Or what would the dividend amounts be at those price ranges, roughly?
And through the chair, again, we can see that one when we get to the models a little better, but roughly speaking, 50% of dividends would pay, or sorry, of royalties, would pay a dividend of roughly $500 million total. On a per capita basis, that amounts to about $750. And if you reduce oil prices, then the dividends are going to fall. So, you know, if you're at $30 oil, royalty goes, and you would be down closer to the $400 level for dividends. But again, that's real easy to show you in the model.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking ahead at the couple of other models that are out there that you're going to present out here shortly, David. But I think my question is pretty obvious in the sense that it wouldn't work. But have you analyzed? I'm on back on page 7, by the way. But have you analyzed or played with the model in any manner that would allow for the production tax to go directly into the permit fund principal? As opposed to the ERA, or is the sustainable draw too heavily dependent on the production, the annual production tax having to flow into the ERA in order to make it a sustainable draw?
Through the chair, we have not modeled that, but based on the experience we've had with modeling, the production tax right now is about $200 million. But production tax can be very large, and at the DOR forecast levels, it's substantially larger than that, a billion plus in production taxes. And if you put that into the principal, it would be unspendable, and it would put the sustainable draw at risk, because you need that money in the earnings reserve account, not the corpus, in order to assure that you can make those payments. It's, I guess, similar to trying to retire and live off your interest earnings. And that works fine as long as you have a nice, steady 7% return. And you can just spend your earnings as you earn them. But if you have a couple years with very low or negative earnings, then you have no current earnings to make that payment. And you need the reserves to rely upon because you've got a responsibility to pay the full 3.3. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I might,
Representative Edgman,
follow up. I don't think anybody in this room can be considered an expert on sovereign wealth funds because there's a great many of them around the globe. But from what little work I have done in trying to understand what a sovereign wealth fund is about, I think most of them would have the arrow from the production tax going into the principal, wouldn't they? Because, like in Norway, for example, that fund is almost, somewhere close to $1 trillion. And you look at Saudi Arabia, now down to $650 billion, and Abu Dhabi and all the other countries. But I think that's a fundamental difference. And if you know that to be the case, maybe you could respond to that.
Through the chair, I think the proper response to that is that we have an unusual situation with our permanent fund. The corpus is unspendable now and at any point in the future. Most sovereign wealth funds are set up as an endowment. There is no differentiation between the principal unspendable and the earnings reserve spendable. You just essentially combine the two accounts. There's no reason to differentiate, and you take your percentage pay or something so that you never really face the problem of running out of money because you have low reserves. Here, it would require a constitutional amendment to make that change.
And that's all right. Follow up, Representative. My last point, and then obviously most other sovereign wealth funds don't pay dividends, so that's another significant change.
Through the chair, a significant change because remember that paying dividends here, if it's $500 million a year, that could change your sustainable draw to $3.8 billion instead of $3.3 billion is another way to look at that. It's sovereign wealth funds typically do not pay dividends. In fact, when Malone, I can't remember his last name, was here, I think. Okay. He said that he thought that dividends were the strangest thing he'd ever seen. Nobody else pays dividends. So, you know, sovereign wealth fund, I don't know that we necessarily need to call it that. It's, the permanent fund is just fine in terms of words. People are used to that. And you could turn it into a sovereign wealth fund or an endowment, but again, with constitutional change.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to impede the progress toward the other models, but I do want to ask this question. Looking ahead to the future, where the state might, again, want to have a capital budget or may need to make investments into the AKLNG project, I understand the AKLNG envisions us dedicating our royalty, our gas royalty, and our future gas production taxes to fund our costs, our share of the cost of that project. But this model envisions all that money being dedicated to the this sustainable flow of money. So I guess I'm going to pontificate and ask a question. So it looks like if we do need to make cash calls, we would be looking at the ERA, where the royalty and production tax were being stored, but it's already being spent for the sustainable draw. Does this put us in a situation where we cannot meet the absent borrowing or using this as collateral? Does this put us in a position where we can't make the cash calls for AKLNG?
Through the chair, it's possible, but remember in the diagram that royalties, which may be gas royalties, may be pledged for something else. Those royalties feed right through to dividends under the Permanent Fund Protection Act. So
they bleed away.
If you did not receive those royalties because they were pledged for something else, it would reduce dividends, not the sustainable draw.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
So in essence, they would bleed away, dilute away. Well, then the second place you might go to if you need to meet a cash call would be any balance in the CBR. But the only only dotted line goes out of the CBR and absent any new oil tax settlements. When would the CBR likely be empty and unavailable for any purpose? Depends on a lot of things, but depends. Okay, great.
Through the chair, the answer to that is it's easy to see when we get to the models, but you can't see that in a diagram.
We'll get there, but thanks, sir.
Okay, any further questions on this model before we move to the next group? Go ahead, David.
Okay, again, starting with the current cash flow and then showing changes envisioned by SB 114 or HB 303. The first change is identical to slide 3. That's a reduction in royalties and moving that 5% over to the general fund. That first change is identical to slide 3 under Permanent Fund Protection Act. But the second change is, notice that the production tax and royalties are not redirected from the general fund to the ERA. They continue to flow into the general fund. So the second change from current law is that you get this POMV payout. Now, obviously, these volatile sources go into the GF so that this plan cannot be as stable as the governor's. But you have a draw that is also variable. It's a percent of balance, and that balance changes over time. So we'll get to that a little more when we see the models and see if the variability is a concern. So third, you'll see that there's no mention of inflation proofing. That doesn't mean there's no inflation proofing. It means there's no specific provision to do it on an annual basis. But if your earnings are 6.9%, and your payout rate is 5%, then theoretically those excess earnings accumulate in the earnings reserve account and can be appropriated from the earnings reserve account to the corpus whenever you choose. So inflation proofing is ad hoc rather than by statutory or rules based formulas. Fourth and finally is that dividends are higher than under the Permanent Fund Protection Act. That's because we're now using, instead of 50% of previous year's royalties, the full undedicated or non-dedicated 74% that flows into the general fund. And again, just envision 1 year's royalties go in, connected by a dashed line, and paid out fully the following year. And again, we do it through the general fund because of the year lag. So now,
Representative Guttenberg.
Follow the slide. You've got the 74% of previous royalties in red, and then you have the red line from general fund to dividend. I assume that relates to that, but you also have the CBR around surrounded in red. What does that indicate? Is it a deficit or starting to?
The CBR. Oh.
The CBR box. Maybe you
here
can't.
On this chart. Are you looking at the next page?
Number four, when it says number four on the top, right. Can you see that the CBR has a red line around it? That's a change. I'm wondering if there's a change or if it's just a graphics.
I think it's around all of them.
It's all of them.
No. It is. Sorry. My mistake. I'm going along with Representative Guerra's math.
Hey, are you all right there?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you. For some reason.
And, Mr. Chairman, just so you know, when I always say this box to this box instead of the green box to here, I can't tell you if that's a red line. I'm colorblind, and I, you know. So don't turn to me for red lines, red boxes. So the next slide compares the two bills. The Permanent Fund Protection Act is in blue. SB 114, HB 303 is in red, and black is both have the same provisions. So both continue the 5%, 0.5% to the school trust and go to the minimum 25% royalty. Then you see the royalties and the production tax are identical in amount, but different flows. Under the Permanent Fund Protection Act, both royalties and production tax flow into the ERA. Under HB 303, both of those revenue sources remain in the general fund as they are now. This is a big deal to the governor. Again, he places high value on general fund stability. So directing the money to the earnings reserve account allows a fixed draw under the governor's plan, and that's about $3.3 billion, versus HB 303's variable draw. 5% doesn't change, but the amount of the draw changes. Inflation proofing, not a big deal in the sense that it's not a conceptual difference. When I say no big deal, I'm really referring to the technical provision in the bill. You can put inflation proofing in the bill or leave it out of the bill. It's a policy choice, and it may be a big policy choice, but in terms of putting it in a bill, it's an easy change to the bill. The dividends, same thing. Huge policy choice, but it's a cross out 74.5 and put 50 in either of the bills. It's a policy change, not a big technical change. So the bills are very, very close conceptually, other than the legal issues involving the contamination of the ERA with money from outside the permanent fund. The only significant difference is the degree of stability.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, I think I'd like to use this opportunity to, David, maybe have you help me better understand when the governor's staff presented the PFPA. One of the features that sort of stuck out to me was that their model actually has a better opportunity to grow more in the future than does the PUMV concept. And I guess I could look up at that schematic and say, well, the royalties go into the ERA as opposed to the general fund, and the CBR, under the governor's proposal, would go into the PF principle, the permit fund principle. So therefore, you got a bigger pot of money in the permit fund principle growing over time, again, assuming long-term projections. And then, but if you put the royalties into the ERA, that's invested in the same portfolio, right, but with more of a bent towards liquidity. So you're looking at a lower interest rate or lower ROI, return investment. And I'm confusing things, but I'm just trying to better understand what would be, from your perspective, the basis of the governor saying his plan actually gives a better opportunity for it to grow, the whole corpus to grow.
Through the chair, the corpus may grow more under the governor's plan because you need more money in there to sustain that $3.3 billion draw. But it really comes down to this. If the production tax is $800 million, which it is now, then the payout under HB 303 of $2.5 billion, roughly, that's just 5% of $50 billion, and that's going to change over time. But for convenience, let's just say it's a $2.5 billion plus $800 billion from the production tax, $3.3 billion. Where the governor's, so it matches the governor's draw exactly. But if oil, and that occurs at about $85 oil, where you have production tax of $800 million. So if oil is less than $85, then the sustainable draw is going to be larger. If oil is greater than $85, then you're going to get more than $800 million flowing in from here, plus your 2.5%. So HB 303 would give you a larger revenue source to the general fund. So it does depend on prices, which one is going to pay more. But your point is that the permanent fund itself would be larger. And under the governor's plan, that's true because this production tax that's going on into the general fund under 303 goes into here.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, David, did you just leave out the other arrow? So what money then can possibly go from the general fund to the CBR underneath SB 114?
Through the chair, I did leave out the arrow. Under 114, or 303, there may be a surplus in the general fund, right? Because if you have high revenue coming in from production tax and you have a POMV, then you can have more than you intended to spend. That money's all available to be spent. You could spend it, or you could deposit it into the CBR or the SBR or any place else you chose to put it.
But it has its potential to grow government if it's sitting there in the general fund. Is that?
That's true, Mr. Chairman, and I think that that's kind of the point, that the Permanent Fund Protection Act offers a more stable revenue stream than HB 303, which is precisely the result that the governor wanted. So the obvious question is, well, if stability is good, then isn't the Permanent Fund Protection Act clearly a better approach? What could be more stable than a fixed draw? But to your question, I think you need to consider several points. That fixed draw is actually highly dependent on attaining the projected rates of return and on the projected oil revenue. So don't be fooled by the term sustainable. These projections under the Permanent Fund Protection Act look forward for 20 years. They have a review of sustainability, but that sustainable draw is not necessarily $3.3 billion every year. It's going to depend on inflation. It's going to depend on oil prices. It depends on earnings. And it may be revised. So I can tell you that our experience, the Permanent Fund's experience, and anybody else's experience at predicting interest rates isn't all that great, and that we're even worse at projecting oil revenues. I don't know that anyone would argue with me on that. You may, but we haven't really done any worse than anybody else worldwide, those that forecast oil prices. The point is that nobody does very well at it. So POMV looks backward 5 years, and the payout's based on actual events rather than on 20-year projections. The POMV is self-adjusting, so I guess you can ask yourself this question, but is your hindsight better than your foresight? And I can assure you that my projections of the past are a whole lot better than my projections of the future. Here, if that appears to be biased, I don't mean it that way. Note that POMV fails the stability test. So this is a trade-off. Do you want that steady, steady general fund flow, or do you want something that may move? If royalties and production tax, as we use in the example, jump by $4 billion and fill the deficit without the need for a payout, that payout still occurs, leaving you with perhaps $2.5 billion that you may tend to spend. Many legislators would say, well, that's good. We need that flexibility. And others would say, that just pushes our spending up, or may tend to push our spending up. So it's something that you need to consider. That's a difficult decision to make. So last year is there a hybrid that offers the comfort of hindsight offered that POMV offers and the stability of the Permanent Fund Protection Act? And certainly, it's real simple. You simply limit the payout from POMV when it's not required. That's really easy to do. And it takes away the primary difference between the Permanent Fund Protection Act and HB 303. So with that simple change, they become very, very close bills.
We've been joined in the audience by Senator McGuire and Representative Vasquez. Representative Wilson had a follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on both of these, even if you're able to kind of limit the portion of it, wouldn't there be a benefit to any of the proposals that we have that we also have something that controls the spending? I mean, it seems like everything's revenue generated, but we're not dealing with what got us here in the first place.
Through the chair, I think that's what the last questions getting at is that if you wanted to add a provision to SB 114, HB 303 companion bills, you could simply say the draw can't give us more money than we spent last year, or gives us 105% or 125%, whatever you choose. So HB 303 can act as a spending limit. But remember that the Permanent Fund Protection Act also acts as a spending limit because it just gives you that fixed amount.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is, in a sense, if all the money we're going to utilize would be one of the two plans, but we have the other taxes that we have all, we have a whole bunch of other revenue-generating bills before us, so the only way it does what you say it does as far as what spits back out is if we're not going to do anything else but one of these plans.
Through the chair, I think that question's a whole lot easier to answer when we get to the models.
That's fine. Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Can you go back one slide, David? Can you tell me, is there a material impact on 303 with the inflation proofing to the principal? And what your thoughts are on that, if it's not designed specifically in the bill?
Through the chair, I guess I see inflation proofing as a big policy decision, but something that you can very easily do. You can use under 303, if you like the concept of inflation proofing when we reach four times the amount of the payout. That works. You can say when we have a large enough CBR balance, we'll begin to inflation proof. There are a number of ways that you could build inflation proofing into any of the plans if you wanted to do that. It's that trade-off between protecting the permanent fund, and when you do that, you're increasing the risk of not being able to make your draw to the general fund.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. I guess I agree it's a policy discussion that we'll have as finance committee members in the legislature, but, I mean, just the way it's drafted now, if you're already dropping the percentage of royalty into the permanent fund principal. I mean, I guess this is more of a question for the permanent fund when they come before us on what their thoughts are, because it looks like if the statutory net income statutes are the same, it seems like the permanent fund principal could drop significantly. And I guess historically, you know, we've inflation proofed to the tune of $17 billion, I think, as a minimum, and there's been years where the total net change to the permanent fund has actually been negative, even when we have infused large amounts of cash into the permanent fund principal. So I guess if it's not going to be permanent anymore, it needs to have a name change, and that's what I'd be afraid of.
Through the chair, none of the plans change the fact that you cannot spend the principal. The only issue is what is in the principal, and do you inflation proof? Because the Constitution says all you have to do is put in 25% of royalties. There is no constitutional provision that requires inflation proofing. Inflation proofing is something that was added years later, so that you can make that argument that we want it absolutely protected, but you can also make the argument that what we really care about it is the real value of the sum of the two accounts. So we don't care whether the money is actually moved or not. And when we do the model, we give you a permanent fund balance. That balance is always the sum of the two accounts. But it does matter, and that's why it's a policy decision that you're going to have to wrestle with. Is it really permanent, or is it an inflation-adjusted thing that I can spend some of it later if I need to?
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my just personal view is that the permanent fund ought to be a permanent fund, and I don't think there's any mincing words that the definition of a permanent fund is something that will be permanent. I think that looking at this graph the way it is under 303, without inflation proofing and with relying specifically on the 25% royalty, and then taking out your statutory net income, it's not permanent anymore. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at page 14, your points 6 and 7, Mr. Teal, I can actually see how the POMV plan might actually fail the stability test, but by my opinion, failing to collect more, failing by collecting more than you expected is a lot easier than failing by collecting less. So that's the kind of failure I could live with, collecting more money than we thought we would. And we could, as you say, fix it by statute, possibly to say that half of any surplus could go back to the corpus and half can stay in the general fund. I don't know. Remember, I guess, that these bills are not designed to fix every element of our fiscal system. They're a big piece, but it's not every piece. And I would note that we do have a spending cap, I think it's in the Constitution, of $2.5 billion plus population plus inflation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's actually doing what it was intended to do, too. I'm not even sure if there's a question in there, but it seems like that's not a bad problem to have. I guess there's not a question.
Is there a question in there?
I guess there's not. Sorry.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, David, I understand the bulk of what you just presented on this bill, but on the dividend sort of reduction, it's not as big under this bill, but you said that the revenue generated under this bill that comes out of the various accounts is going to be slightly larger. How is it that the revenue is slightly larger coming out of this bill than the governor's when the reduction of the dividend is less under this bill than the governor's?
Again, I would say let's wait until we get to the models.
Okay.
And I mean, the cash flow diagrams are to, I think, help you see where money flows, and they'll point out some decision points. The decision points are one slide away, so we can talk about them. And I think all the points are valid that you're raising, but you're sort of getting a little bit ahead of me, and that's fine.
Wait a slide.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Teal.
So we're talking about spending limits and that sort of thing, the policy decisions. And the third bill in front of you is HB 224. That does incorporate some spending limits. And it also has a strong rules-based system here. This is just a waterfall approach rather than a clockwork approach. It's probably more elegant if you care about that. But it sets forth a number of rules and statutes. And we'll just walk through those rules. I know Representative Hawker walked through this chart already, and he did it very briefly and concisely. And so I'm going to probably be briefer than that, but I think he did an excellent job of explaining how his bill works. But the audience may be different, so let's just walk through it again. Statutory net income flows to the earnings reserve account from the permanent fund. That happens under all plans. Now, what we have here is that POMV payout occurs just as it did under HB 303. But the first priority was to fill the deficit under this plan. Remember, the current plan, the first priority is to pay a dividend. In HB 303, you're paying a dividend out of royalties. So again, you always have a dividend. This plan says fill the deficit. That's the most important thing we have. So the entire payout may go towards filling the deficit. If the payout fills the deficit, then there would be some money available for dividends. But it's not all available for dividends. There's a schedule that says we pay dividends based on between $250 and $2,000, depending on the reserve balances. Okay, that's the technical thing. I would say that you pay dividends based on the long-term fiscal health of the state as measured by reserve balances. So, it again, very, very strong protection to the Treasury here. And some may say that that protection comes at the expense of dividends. They are a second priority. You're going to fill the deficit no matter what. That can change, and Representative Hawker did suggest a few ways that, you know, we can just say dividends are this much. That's a policy call. Now, once you've filled, or once you've paid dividends, then any remaining money will go into the CBR until you've repaid that liability. Again, as Rep. Sadler noticed, you don't ever want to fill the CBR beyond what you owe it. So once your general fund obligation has been repaid, the remainder goes to the SBR. Now, if the payout doesn't fill the deficit, then obviously the remainder of this waterfall doesn't happen. And in fact, you're going to be drawing from the CBR or the SBR just as you do now.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way Representative Hawker presented it, he estimated it would produce about $2.4 billion in revenue. We've got currently got about a $5.2 billion budget. So unless things change, once his plan kicks into effect, we've got a zero dividend under his plan. And then he's got the double whammy of if there's ever an income tax, it says no dividend ever. So there seems to be two ways where his plan guarantees a zero dividend. One is as long as it's producing his estimate of $2.4 billion, you get no dividend. And then he has a specific provision that if an income tax is ever adopted, then there's no dividend either. I wanted to point that out because there are two scenarios where you get no dividend under his plan.
Through the chair, I think the only response to that is to say there's a lot of policy embedded in this bill and in any bill. That, for instance, the POMV payout of 4.5%, that's a policy call. It could be 5%. It's a simple change to the bill. But remember that all of these payouts are based on a five-year moving average. So when you say 5% payout, that's not 5% of the current balance. That's essentially 5% of the balance that you had 3 years ago, or the average balance for the past 5 years, which is about the same. So that your effective payout is probably about 0.2 percentage point below the stated. So that 5% is really 4.8. There's more inflation proofing than there appears to be. This plan, with a 4.5% payout, provides apparently less money than a 5% payout. But remember this, that with a 4.5% payout, you've got more money accumulating in the fund. 4.5% of $70 billion is greater than 5% of $60 billion. So in the long run, a 4.5% payout can be a higher payout than a 5%. Does that make sense?
It's math.
It's math, yeah.
Because you're not paying a dividend.
Well, it's because you are paying less out, meaning you've got a higher balance. the higher balance gives you more earnings. And again, the math, if you're at 70 million because you've not paid out as much, 4.5% of 70 is greater than 5% of 60. So don't be fooled by a stated payout rate. It's that trade-off in the payoff rate is intergenerational. The lower rate means I'm favoring future generations over this one. I'm restricting spending in the current years, near term. So, again, all those policy decisions I think we'll talk about on the next slide.
On this slide, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So kind of with Representative Guerra, though, it may, the 4.5%, that the ERA is going to grow as well if we're only taking 4.5% of POMV. So right now it might influence the dividend more if we don't cover it right now. But as time flows and the ERA gets larger, then there and we balance our, you know, we cut down our spending, then that would give money for the dividends because we're keeping more, like you just said, into the ERA, so back to the future versus now.
Exactly. So again, to explain graphically what happens is this payout with a 4.5% may grow larger than the 5% payout. Because the payout is larger, depending on what you do with spending and what happens with other revenues, you may fill the deficit. As you fill the deficit, that's going to spill over into dividends. Now, your dividends won't grow very rapidly until you have enough deficits that this overflow hits the CBR, fills it up, and the higher CBR will allow higher dividends to be paid. So it's, as I said, it's, there's a lot of policy built into this. The waterfall is a very elegant way of treating things over the long term, making things very smooth. It's a different kind of plan, but it's really not that much different than the other two.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, David. I understand growing the earnings reserve faster. Well, who wouldn't want to do that in the abstract? But under this plan, you're very, very, very far away from having any money left over after money goes into the general fund to go into dividends. I mean, it's not even close at this point, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct, and you'll see that in the model.
Thanks. Any questions, Representative Edgemond, before we move on?
Yeah, just a couple additional points, and I think you touched upon this a moment ago. You could actually, to make this graph complete, actually have an arrow pointing from the CBR across and up to the dividends as well. Because if I remember Representative Hawker's explanation, yeah, you can use additional money from the CBR to make the dividend any size you wanted to at any given time. So it seems to me there should be an arrow pointing up as well, not just from the CBR over to the general fund all the way down the dividend. I think if I were drawing this, I would put that arrow up there. And the second thing to point out is that this model requires almost $1 billion worth of reductions in order to make it work. So that's a significant difference between this model and Senator McGuire's model. But if I might, Mr. Chairman,
I have a
couple of sort of standing back at the 40,000-foot level questions. And one would be to ask you, David, can we? Is there any alternative to any of these three plans in terms of going forward and achieving a sustainable budget?
Next slide.
Well, I before I go to the next slide on that, I think there are a couple things. We may have something other than the most recent version. When we modeled this, we didn't see a CBR thing. Now, remember that when we model, we can only model rules. We can't model, well, the legislature can do this at any time. It's impossible to model that. That's why both we and the governor's office have a real hard time modeling, and you can change the sustainable draw every 4 years if you need to. Oh, okay. We don't know if you need to. There's no rule for changing it other than changing the assumptions on interest rates and so on. So that, yes, you can always pay dividends, enhanced dividends from the CBR. You can pay dividends if you wanted to. Make sure that you don't always pay the full deficit here, that some is always reserved for a dividend. In other words, you don't have to eliminate dividends. You could reserve a portion of the payout for dividends. You could move some from the CBR to pay dividends. But that doesn't appear to be the intent of the draft we saw of HB 224. That bill was designed to make filling deficits the top priority. Now,
Representative Edgman.
Well, and I think that's a distinction worth noting, but that's not the point that I wanted to get to. I guess the other question, another sort of real general question, was what's the opportunity cost, or is there a measurable difference between the opportunity costs involved with all three of these models if we don't take any action this year at all in the legislature? You know, I heard with the governor's plan it was $100, $150 million or something like that, but what's the cost of not doing anything with all three of the models? Is it all sort of similar in terms of the amount of money we'll lose by not putting this together?
I hope I can answer that question again when we get to the model. I keep saying that, but but as you noted, you think that this bill might not work without major reductions, $950 million or so. And again, I think when we get to the model, you'll see that it works without reductions of that size. So,
further questions before we move on to the next modeling? Do you have more?
Well, I do want to move on the model. I don't want to delay this, but I don't think I've articulated my question very well. Under the governor's plan, if we didn't do anything this year, as I understand it, the opportunity cost would be to lose about $100, $150 million in terms of investments, putting the whole concept together. Can you compare that to Senator McGuire's model versus Representative Hawker's model?
Through the chair, I think that under the governor's plan, he anticipated moving or consolidating some of the reserve accounts and earning larger amounts because of that. That may be true, but I would also argue that there's no reason to invest the entire CBR at 1.something% interest rates. You could invest it at a higher rate, especially if you were assured that you weren't going to need it anytime real soon. Well, the best way to not need it real soon is to do any one of these three plans, because they reduce your CBR draw substantially, and therefore you can change your investment. It's regulation. It's not anything in statute or something. It's just prudent investing rules say that don't go buy real estate if you're going to need that money in the next year or two. So if we get to the point where CBR draws are small enough and they don't see us using the money, they can earn higher interest rates. But what they've done with the CBR is, remember, we had two accounts. One was the higher return. That's been eliminated. And again, they have triggers that say, if you might need this money, we cannot invest it long term. So, yes, there is an opportunity cost if we don't do the governor's plan, but the opportunity cost might be about the same for any and all of these.
Thank you. Representative Sadler, and then Representative Vera Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, I'm not sure. I think there's a couple different places where the governor's plan allows for an opportunity cost. I think one of them is that if the governor assumes that if we don't adopt his plan or something similar to it, then we have to draw from the CBR, thus depriving ourselves of the interest, the usufruct. The second opportunity cost, I think, that Representative Edgeman is talking about is the investment horizon difference. If you have to have it short term, mm-hmm. you have to make it more liquid and less shooting for the moon, getting a high return. And I guess my question is, would that second factor be about the same for all of them? You know, the difference between investing for the long term, investing for short term liquidity, be about the same regardless?
Through the chair, that's my guess, is that all of your opportunity costs, whether regardless of which of the two you're naming, would be about the same under either any of these three plans.
And follow up, that nice happens.
And I would argue, I guess, that that's probably the finer details of each of them. There's larger replumbing and larger impacts than that mm-hmm. more fine-tuned cost. But we'll see when we get to the model.
Okay. So,
Representative Garrett.
Thanks, Chair. Oh, this will be really quick. I just got a note, and I'm pretty sure Representative Hawker mentioned this during his presentation, but when I talked about that, what I consider the double whammy provision, if you adopt an income tax, the dividend, then you also get no dividend. It's in the bill on page 4 that it says the amount of the permanent fund dividend shall be zero if a personal income tax is assessed. So that's how you get the zero dividend. I just want to make sure nobody thought I was making that up, given the note that I got.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can we move on to the next model?
That's the model, but there are a couple things I wanted to talk about. The policies embedded, and one of them here was the 4.5%, but dividends need not be eliminated. We've talked about that a little bit. We also talked about dividends reflecting the long-term fiscal health because they're based on reserves. But in addition, the plan makes it clear that dividends are simply another government expenditure that competes with other government expenditures. You don't get a dividend if you've got a deficit. Spend too much, your dividend goes away. You get a dividend if you don't spend too much. And if we look at stability, you can see that all windfall revenue would be available for spending. Now, it may appear that the POMV payout acts as a spending limit because it's limited to the amount of the deficit. So the implication there is you only get to draw as much as your deficit is. But if you think that if the legislature knew that money is available, it could simply spend more. And by spending more, you increase your deficit. By increasing your deficit, you increase your draw. Now, in some people's opinions, that may be a weakness, but consider that the lack of spending constraints is no different than what we have today. And that increased spending will clearly be seen as competing with dividends, and the rules, no matter what kind of rules you make, can't truly control spending in any of the other models either. So, again, I don't see that as a major weakness. If you were to have a downside impact, remember that royalties and production taxes and everything continues going to the general fund. So it's going to be more volatile. It's going to be as volatile as we have right now. More volatile than the other two plans because they divert some of the volatile revenue to dividends. So there would be more volatility in this plan than in the others. And that lack of oil revenue would be first absorbed by reducing or eliminating dividends and then dipping into reserves, just as the other plans dip into reserves. So to summarize, it's very similar to HB 303 in that it enhances general fund revenue with a payout from earnings. It doesn't shift as much of the volatility. Significant differences between the two POMV payouts are that 224 makes dividends a second priority after filling your deficits with current cash flow, and it varies dividends depending on the health of reserves, which is long-term health, rather than on revenue from royalties, which I would considered to be short-term health. In other words, the state is doing great this year because oil prices spiked and dividends will spike right along with it. So the dividends reflect short-term health if they're based on royalties, long-term health if they're based on reserves.
Mr. Chair. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, David. We're just doing cash flow modeling or cash flow charting. When we get to the modeling, you're going to include all of the other considerations in the mill besides just cash flow, I assume.
The model's capable of doing that through the chair, of looking at changes to expenditures, changes to oil prices, taxes, whatever you want to change, you can.
So if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
In this bill, we're just doing the cash flow, but the major considerations in the bill deal with the distribution, the royalty, and the income tax. So I just want to make sure that we're going to see all of the mechanisms that go into a bill or are not in it besides cash flow. That's what I'm saying. Are we going to get there?
Through the chair, I hope so. It's 10 after.
Okay. All right.
So.
Point.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Real short. So what you're saying, Mr. Teal, just correct me if I'm wrong, this makes the dividend a regular part of state spending, number two after filling the dividend of the operating budget. It seems to me that this rationalizes the cash flow. Right now, the dividend is kind of a dotted line connection to state finances. From an accounting viewpoint, this makes more net sense. It just shows the cash flow the way it should be. And it also has the benefit of linking the dividend to spending. If you spend more in the general fund, you get less dividend. If you demand more dividend, you're going to have less for the – okay, I got it. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-chair, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teal. You know, we're all trying to find new, more inventive ways to try and discuss with the public on what to do. And, you know, I'm certainly trying to do that myself. So is there any reason, if we're going to have to spend the public's permanent fund, the public, if we're going to start either taxing the public or taking away permanent fund dividends from the public, is there a process, do you feel, that we could develop to allow the public to have a say in where their permanent fund is spent? There's people around here that say we need money for public safety or corrections or maybe the Cooperative Extension Service they feel does a very good job. Is there an opportunity here where if, again, we have to take people's permanent fund dividends away from them, they would have an opportunity to say where they want their permanent fund dividends spent instead of legislators or state government as a whole trying to do that? I think it might be something new to look at, allow the public to have a little bit more say, at least in how their government spends their money. My thought is that departments would be able to absorb that money into their programs. Commissioners still have the ability to move money around under their jurisdiction in their departments. So if money came into the university system or education system for K-12 or pre-K, money that they're already putting there, they could pull that back and use it where they needed it. But I think people should maybe have a say in where they're putting their permanent fund dividend. Is there a way that we could incorporate those discussions? I know that we've got some of the members here that have legislation already on using a permanent fund dividend. And I think maybe we need to think a little bit outside the box from what the current discussions have been, because we're going to have to find something that turns the corner on this. The public's not convinced at this point as much as we've reduced the budget, but I'm looking for new options.
Mr. Chairman, I think HB 224 gives you that option. It makes the connection very clear. I think that people right now see the government, see the permanent fund dividend as sort of their right. The money comes from the sky. It's not part of the budget process. I mean, it's appropriated, but it's way down on the fiscal summary. It isn't included in revenue. It's not included in expenditures. Essentially, the money appears to just fall out of the sky. The truth is that the dividend is a government check just like any other government check, and that it's very protected now, that under the flow of HB 224 and under some of these other plans, it becomes very obvious that the dividend competes with K-12, senior benefits, and not just the cash benefit programs, but everything for general fund dollars. Once the public understands that, I think you'll get what you ask for, because the public will then understand it doesn't matter whether it's a capital project or whether it's K-12 or, you know, some expenditure in the Department of Law. Every expenditure means there's less money for my dividend. And if that happens, you may have the public looking over your shoulder a little more than they do now as you prepare the budget. So I guess fair warning, be careful what you ask for.
Mr. Chair. Quite frankly, with any one of these programs, none of them create new money. None of them create new money. You're still taking in 224, you take up to $2 billion a year out of the permanent fund through a POMV type of a fashion, but you're still with a $2.5 billion deficit. You know, you can say, well, cut the budget another $1 billion and just take the rest out of the CBRs. There would be absolutely no money for permanent fund dividend payouts under this for several years unless we were to get to that point. None of them create any other funds. I'm thinking something quite as simple as click, kick, click, and give type of a program where people can say, here's the department, here's an appropriation here. That's where I would like my permanent. If you're going to take my money, I want to be able to say where it's going to go. And it's quite as simple as something is pick, click, and give type of a program where the different departments where people in Alaskans could say, if you're going to take my permanent fund dividend, at least let me dictate where I think that money should go into programs that I think is important.
Yeah, I was thinking in more general terms, Mr. Chairman, but you could do something like that, and that's very specific, very individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We've got more questions before we move on to the final model. Go ahead, Representative Pruitt.
I was going to ask, can we please move to the model?
All right with everybody? Go ahead, Mr. Teal.
Well, actually, there is one slide left, and I think it's a really important slide. So I would like to go over that one. And that is the decision points on the way here. This is just a cash flow. It doesn't look quite the same because I couldn't fit all the boxes on any one of the models. But here you have production taxes, royalty, and your less volatile taxes. Your first decision is, do I want those going to the general fund or to the earnings reserve account? Do I want stability of the fixed draw versus the good enough stability of a percent of market value? You don't need to worry about this choice very much because that choice is really made for you under choice number four. If you want the governor's plan, then you can't put this money in the general fund. If you want a POMV payout, you can. So your second choice is whether royalties go to permanent fund principal. Well, that's just a question of, do you want to reduce it to 25% or leave it where it is? The question there is, do you want to save and harvest at the same time? You're talking tens of millions of dollars on this decision versus the hundreds of millions of dollars when you get to decision number three. So since we want to get to the model, I'm just going to go through this pretty quickly, but the decision here, the first one is number three. Again, we've talked about it. Do you want greater protection when you know that greater protection brings greater risk. So this payout decision is your first really critical decision. Here's the trade-off. Do you favor a forward-looking, manually adjusting fixed draw that promises greater stability, or do you want a backward-looking, self-adjusting draw that offers less stability? You can have a spending restraint under high oil prices. It's a key element of the governor's plan. But POMV's weakness in that area, as we have already talked about, can be overcome by just incorporating a limit on the draw. And if you wanted to here, you can say it's 105 or 125, pick your choice, so that that you're really limiting the payout if you don't need it, in other words, at high oil prices. The POMV payout can be turned into a spending limit. If you choose the variable draw, then you could also say, well, what payout rate do I choose? We've talked about that. 4.5% can actually be a higher dollar payout than 5. But that trade-off is between the current generation and future generations to some extent. But you also know that a lower payout rate now, or lower payout dollars now, means larger deficits in the short term. So do you want to reduce spending or increase taxes to fill the gap? Or do you have sufficient reserves to fill the deficits? The longer you wait to act, the lower your reserves and the higher your risk of failure, or the more important it is to get the money flowing according to plan. Because if you don't act now, your reserve balances simply take away your choices on the amount of payout you need to fill your deficit. So your second critical choice is the amount and source of dividends. We talked about inflation proofing being fully protected, unspendable. But at least it has a spin-off. It earns interest, and that interest is spendable. But if you pay higher dividends, you're going to have lower reserves and greater risk of unfillable deficits. And remember that once you spend money on dividends, you never get it back. You don't earn interest on it. It's just gone. So higher dividends are the critical element here in determining what your reserve level is going to be, and your reserve level determines the risk of the plan. You continue to pay dividends as you are, your risk increases to the point that you can't adopt any of these plans because you can't be assured of making the payouts. There's another trade-off here with dividends, and that's the amount of the dividend and the economy. Clearly, the more you reduce dividends, the better off the Treasury is, but that's not necessarily the same thing as the better off the economy is. In fact, it may be exactly the opposite. The source of money for dividends may not be a critical choice in terms of maintaining healthy reserves, because it doesn't really matter whether the dividends come from royalties or earnings. The bottom line is that higher dividends reduce the amount available to spend in the general fund for other things. So that choice is something that you have to make. It's important. Dividends reflect the health of, you know, we talked about the long-term health versus short-term health. Well, why not do both? You can have a plan that takes X percent of royalties, reflecting the short-term health. And you can have a kicker that says, we also will add to dividends based on the long-term health of the economy. Or the Treasury, I should say, not the economy. So everything here has a trade-off. And with every trade-off, there's probably a sweet spot. So deciding what to do with the money that remains after you fill the deficit, after you pay dividends, is probably not worth talking about. You're home free. You can set up rules for that, or you can leave it to future legislators to decide that. So, any questions before we really do go to the model?
Following questions.
Because I think once it goes away, I have a hard time getting it back.
All right. You know, David, this has probably brought up a lot of questions from everybody, and I don't know if we've got enough time to continue through the model. We might have to come back next week in the AM or something to see where we head with this. But if you want to go ahead, you got about 5 minutes more is all.
Yeah. Nope. We'll see what we can do. The objective in putting the models together is to compare the plans on equal footing. Now, all options use the same oil forecast, the same expenditures, and the same interest rates. They have to if you're going to compare them, since it's too easy to say, well, my plan works because I've used a higher oil revenue forecast. The governor's plan actually does use a higher forecast in his model. We did not adopt it. We used the official numbers. It doesn't change the conclusion significantly. So using those constant inputs doesn't mean the model's inflexible. It just means that we need to start out with identical models before we start making changes. And when we do make changes, we can see how that change affects each of the models. Because clearly, you can cut expenditures, you can increase revenues without a model or without a plan or under any of the plans. They're independent decisions. So in all plans, whatever gap remains after the replumbing is first filled from the CBR and then from the ERA. That's just an assumption we've made because we say you've got to pull the money from somewhere if you think you're going to spend it. So unplanned draws are shown in red. And this is the current plan, or status quo, business as usual, whatever you want to call it, that's on the chart right now. And here you can see that the unplanned draws from the ERA start when the CBR is gone. That occurs in about FY19. At that point, you begin filling the entire deficit with a draw from the ERA. It's not a draw, it's just spending it. There's no rule for it. And you can do that until the ERA also vanishes. That occurs in 21 or 22. From that point on, you earn money because you still have a permanent fund balance. And we're assuming that you spend your earnings as you earn it. But under the current system or status quo, it clearly doesn't reach expenditures. So what it means when the revenue bars don't reach expenditures is that all your reserves are gone. The current earnings of the ERA cannot fill the deficit, and your expenditures must fall to your level of revenue. So you're cutting roughly $2.5 billion from the current budget.
David, that looks to me like, so by then, it looks like we would have no dividend checks going out. Is that correct? Probably.
Well, one would think so, because this is broken. The white space here means that the plan is broken, and the rest of the graphs don't even make any sense, because you cannot be in a situation where you're spending money you don't have. So there are several options. I mean, you don't have to stop dividends. for instance, if you cut inflation proofing instead, your gap fills because you're saving roughly $1 billion a year that used to go into the corpus of the fund and couldn't be spent, and now you're just saying, we're not going to inflation proof anymore, we're going to spend that money instead. But you see that it works through 25, but it doesn't work much longer. You could also say, well, let's take a different option there. Let's assume that we're going to cut dividends instead of inflation proofing as soon as we begin those draws from the earnings reserve account. Okay. Again, you can fill your deficits now. And again, you're drawing from reserves at too rapid a rate, and you got about two or three more years, and then you're broken again. So that's at the fall oil forecast, which is 50 and growing. If you want to switch, I can't even read these, $30 oil, you know, that doesn't look so good. And even if you also stop inflation proofing at $30 oil, your reserves are gone. You have no dividends, no inflation proofing, and a plan that will be broken in by 2030. So that's really the status quo. Those are your options under it, I believe. Of course, you could also say, well, what if we just cut? And let's cut 500 million. Well, now you're having something that at least gives you a glide path that may be acceptable. So there are a lot of variables here, a lot of choices you can make, and those are the, you know, I guess you could call them do nothing options, but it really is doing something. But I don't know if you call it a plan. Those are simply done by annual appropriations, keeping exactly the same plumbing that you've got right now. So moving to the governor's plan, I'm not going to go through that. I'm just going to go ahead and say the governor's plan does a number of things. It puts dividends at 50% of royalties. So there are your dividends at somewhere in the $700 to $900 range. But these blue bars are oil revenue. And note that they fell here. Our current revenue was about $2 billion a year. Under the governor's plan, that revenue falls. Well, it falls because you've diverted royalties and production tax away from the general fund to the earnings reserve, reducing your normal revenue, but giving you a $3.3 billion draw, or sustainable draw. That's this line. And you can see that you have to draw from the CBR to fill the deficit, which still remains. Your CBR vanishes. When your CBR vanishes, you have unplanned draws from the ERA. So the red bars here, the unplanned draws, don't mean that the plan fails. It means that you're breaking the rules. And you're breaking them for what appears to be a short time. Nevertheless, here you get the model fails the real value test. Because you're taking draws from the ERA that were unplanned, your permanent fund balance is not growing fast enough to keep pace with inflation. And that's one test that we have to say, does the plan work? That's what the governor wanted, is to keep pace with inflation here. So it fails to do that. Reducing the draw isn't going to help. Reducing the draw simply means you're going to have a larger unplanned draw, giving you exactly the same net results. And that's 330, so I don't know if we want to stop here or come back next week.
David, we do have to get to some other commitments that we have, and we're going to need to come back to this model, I'm sure. Hopefully our finance subcommittees are going to be wrapping up here shortly, and by next week we should have some freed up time in the AM that we'll have to come back to this. And so I hate to do it, but we do have other commitments. Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I've received any positive impact. Well, I have lots of impact, you know, on these different plans. I don't think any one of them has stood out in the emails that I've got. I think it's going to take some outside-the-box thinking to continue to move forward. We'll continue to do that as this committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any of the committee members have questions on specific bills, please get them in writing to Jane. We'll get some answers back, and we have some other questions you want to ask about this modeling that we are going to come back to. David, did you have a final comment?
I guess I'd like to make the offer to anyone on the committee or other legislators, if they're interested, to come over, run through the model. It might really help them ask questions when we do get back to the model in full committee. They can understand the model much better if they see it. This is a poor venue for trying to review a model. It's really easier to do with one-on-one or at most small groups, because you get the what about this, what about this, and you can actually respond to particular things that someone wants. Yeah.
Anybody needs to do that, David's going to make himself available for you. With that, at tomorrow's House Finance Committee meeting, we'll have a meeting at 1:30 again, and we'll have an update on AKLNG, the funds expended, and the FY17 funding request by the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue and the Department of Law. And with that, at 3:37, we are adjourned.